Today we'll be looking at the theory of compensating wage differentials. Up until this point, we've looked at labor demand in quite a bit of detail and labor supply in quite a bit of detail. We've also put demand and supply together in earlier chapters to examine some basic models of reasons for wage differences over time and across individuals. Now we're going to look at wage differences across individuals and across alternative jobs in quite a bit more detail. And the first model we're going to use is this theory of compensating wage differentials. This notion of compensating wage differentials is based on the assumption that wage differences can be used to compensate workers for differences in non-pecuniary characteristics of alternative jobs. Non-pecuniary, again, means non-monetary. The theory of compensating wage differentials suggests that wage differences exist that can be used to compensate workers for differences in things such as the level of risk, level of job stress, and so on across different jobs. This isn't a particularly new theory. The basic theory goes back to Adam Smith back in 1776 in The Wealth of Nations. Let's look at a basic model that'll help illustrate this concept. We're going to start with a somewhat contrived example where there are two occupations that, although they're different jobs or different types of work, are initially perceived by workers as being equivalent in all attributes, that the educational requirements, levels of job stress, working conditions, level of job risk, and other factors are perceived at least as being equivalent between the two jobs. In that case, we'd expect that labor supply adjustments would equate wages between the two occupations, as illustrated in these two diagrams. Actually, here, a quote from Chapter 10 of The Wealth of Nations might help explain this. As Adam Smith says, the whole of the advantages and disadvantages of the different employments of labor and stock must, in the same neighborhood, be either perfectly equal or continually tending to equality. If in the same neighborhood there was any employment evidently either more or less advantageous than the rest, so many people would crowd into it in the one case, and so many would desert it in the other, that its advantages would soon return to the level of other employments. This at least would be the case in a society where things were left to follow the natural course, where there was perfect liberty, and where every man was perfectly free both to choose what occupation he thought proper and to change it as often as he thought proper. Every man's interest would prompt him to seek the advantageous and to shun the disadvantageous employment. So basically, what Adam Smith is saying here is that in general, jobs have to be equivalent to workers, because if one job is more desirable than another, people would flood into that, lowering the wages in that job until it's equivalent to other jobs. If one job is less desirable, people would depart from that job until the wages rise enough to make it equivalent to other jobs. Here, since we're starting with a situation where the jobs are perceived as being equivalent in every other aspect, we'd expect wages would have to be the same. Because if, for example, Occupation X paid higher wages than Occupation Y and they were equivalent in other ways, people would leave from Occupation Y and go into Occupation X. Supply would fall in Occupation Y, raising the wage. Supply would rise in Occupation X, lowering the wage, until the wage rates were the same in the two markets. However, suppose we just change this, we perturb this a little bit, by allowing for the possibility that job risk is greater in one job than another. But let's suppose, for example, that workers, as we said, didn't initially know this, and then suddenly discover that one job is riskier than the other. In particular, we're going to assume that job risk is greater in Occupation Y. What's going to happen here is workers are going to, since they started off with the same wage here, leave Occupation Y and enter into Occupation X. Because originally the two jobs paid the same amount, but one, again, and when risk was perceived as being the same, but now when the workers realize that Occupation Y is more dangerous than Occupation X, they're going to depart from Occupation Y and enter X. Now, as that occurs, wages rise in Occupation Y, as we see with the leftward shift in the supply curve there, and wages will fall in Occupation X due to an increase in the supply of labor. Now, this migration continues until the wage differences between the two markets is just large enough to compensate workers for the risks that they face. In other words, the migration will stop once the wage in Occupation Y is large enough and the wage and occupation in X is low enough so that the two jobs are again perceived as being equal. Now the wage differences here, which are illustrated both on the left diagram, between the wage in the less risky occupation, occupation X, which is W prime, and the wage in the more risky occupation, W double prime, can be thought of as being risk premium, that it's the amount that the worker, the last worker has to be paid in order to induce them, in a sense, to stay in occupation Y. So that, for example, if the wage rate in occupation Y is $12 and the wage rate in occupation X is $8 per hour, then the individual must be, receive a compensation of $3 additional per hour to compensate them for the additional risk received in occupation Y as compared to X. So that wage difference we can think of as being the risk premium associated with the risk differential that exists between occupation X and Y. Now, holding other things constant, ceteris paribus, we'd expect that a similar compensating wage differential would exist for differences in any other characteristic of jobs, such as differences in working conditions, job stress, educational requirements, and so on. Anything else, basically, that would make jobs either more or less desirable. In general, we'd expect that more pleasant jobs will offer lower wages than less pleasant jobs, holding other job characteristics constant. Let's, for example, just take a little digression and talk about educational requirements. Suppose that two jobs are equivalent, except one job requires a bachelor's degree and another job requires only a high school degree. But in terms of stress, in terms of how pleasant the job is and so forth, the two jobs are otherwise equivalent. Now, in general, you'd expect that in order to induce people to acquire the additional training, wages would have to be higher in the job that required more education. If we continue this on to higher levels of education, one of the reasons why physicians and individuals with higher levels of education get paid more than people with lower levels of education is because wage differentials have to exist to induce people to acquire the additional education. Obviously, there are other factors for some of these wage differentials as well, including restrictions on entry into some of these markets. In this module, though, we're only going to focus on equilibrium wage differences where there are no barriers to mobility. In particular, let's talk about the assumptions we're going to be making here, and we've been implicitly making already. The three assumptions that we're going to make is that first, workers attempt to select the occupation that maximizes their utility, not their income. Secondly, that workers have perfect information about all aspects of the job, all the characteristics of the job. And thirdly, that sufficient labor mobility exists. Let's talk about each of these in a bit more detail. That the first condition here, that workers are trying to maximize utility, not their income, is, I think, an assumption which most people would find fairly reasonable. Obviously, if workers are only interested in their income, you wouldn't expect to see any compensating wage differentials exist because wages would have to be equalized across occupations. But in fact, most people, when they choose a job, make the choices on the basis of all the attributes of the job. We do see that more risky jobs, holding other things constant, do pay more. We do see that workers have to be paid more to work in less pleasant climates. We do see that workers are willing to accept lower wages if the job is more pleasant or more secure or has other desirable characteristics. All these observed phenomena suggest that workers, in fact, do select their occupation based on other factors. And we do observe that individuals, when faced with choices, sometimes will accept a lower-paying job if, on average, the benefits or the whole package associated with that job seems more desirable to them, regardless of how much pay the job happens to offer. Second condition is perhaps a little bit more restrictive and one which may be a little bit more troubling in many applications. We'll see this in more detail in the next class. But first, we're going to assume for now at least that workers have perfect information about all job characteristics. Now, the reason for making this assumption or why this assumption is necessary for compensating wage differentials should be fairly obvious that, as the example we've just gone through suggests, if workers did not know that one job is riskier than another, they couldn't select between the two jobs based upon that risk. Okay. And in particular, this is going to present some problems for models of job risk. Just as a preview of that, we can note, for example, that firms might have an incentive to misstate or perhaps to understate the true amount of risk associated with a job. That if you ask a potential employer how risky your particular job is, it's quite likely that they may have, or that whoever is conducting the interviews may have an incentive perhaps to not fully state all the dangers that exist on the job. And a typical response, for example, might be to suggest that, well, there have been some injuries on the job. However, most of those were caused by workers who weren't following established safety procedures, and that as long as you're careful, the job is perfectly safe. Now, the problem here, perhaps, is that workers may interpret that as suggesting that they, in fact, face less risk than they're likely to, because there's a fair amount of empirical evidence to suggest that individuals systematically, perhaps, underestimate the amount of risk that they're facing, and perhaps overestimate their own ability to engage in safe behavior. For example, when studies are conducted asking people whether they're above average in terms of how, when people are asked whether they're more safe than a typical driver or less cautious than a typical driver, somewhere around 80 to 85% of the survey respondents generally claim that they're substantially safer than, or they're substantially more careful than an average driver on the road. A little bit of logic suggests perhaps that that's not likely to be the case in practice. If workers do systematically overestimate how careful they themselves are, then they may understate, for example, the amount of risks that they face. So in order for these compensating wage differentials, though, to fully adjust or fully compensate differences in non-wage characteristics, the workers have to have perfect information about all those non-wage characteristics. The last point is that sufficient labor mobility exists. Now, sufficient is a somewhat loose term, and basically the reason why it's left in this loose form is because, you can have different results, or you can think of this as being perhaps a longer run model or a shorter run model, depending on how mobile labor is. Let's think about that a little bit. That labor mobility here takes two basic forms in general when we talk about labor mobility. The first is geographical mobility, which is the ability to move from one physical place to another. The second is mobility among occupations, or mobility between jobs, or among jobs. Now, the first type, mobility, or geographical mobility, it's obvious that there are some barriers to mobility, that family ties, ties of having family members in a particular location or a particular region, ties to friends, to neighbors, and so on, often serves as a barrier to moving from one location to another. Individuals who are risk averse may prefer a known environment to one which is unknown, even if everything else appears to be equivalent. There's also very large cost quite often of moving, the cost of moving possessions, the cost of acquiring new information, the cost of finding new dwellings, the transaction costs of selling houses, perhaps if the household owns a house, and so on. That all those things serve as barriers to mobility geographically. There's also, though, quite a bit of barriers to mobility from one job to another or from one occupation to another, with the latter being even perhaps more serious or having larger costs of mobility. That, in general, once someone has been on a given job for a certain period, well, for a relatively substantial period of time, they often establish friendships with their coworkers, which serves as a barrier to moving from one job to another. They've acquired quite a bit of perhaps firm-specific training, which will not be portable in other jobs and which will lower their potential earnings in alternative occupations or alternative firms. And again, risk aversion also could play a role here. However, even if one's workers pick a given job and a given occupation and stay in that until they end their career, there's still going to be some labor mobility induced by the fact that every year there are some people who leave occupations or retire. There are also some new entrants, which involves individuals selecting that first job that they're going to choose. So one source of labor mobility, and one which shouldn't be overlooked here, is the fact that we always have some labor mobility based upon the new entrants coming into different labor markets. so that, for example, if it was decided or if in general it was agreed that working as a computer programmer was a more desirable occupation today because of changes in technology or changes in the structure of programming or changes in the ease of programming or changes in the rewards associated with programming, the financial rewards associated with that, even if you wouldn't see very many truck drivers or very many physicians or very many engineers perhaps decide to leave their current occupations and become computer programmers, you might see an awful lot of high school students decide to major in computer science when they're in college, for example. Similarly, if engineering became more or less desirable, you'd expect to see more or fewer people majoring in engineering. So even here, even though there may not be very much mobility once people adopt a particular career, and in general, in terms of broad occupational categories, workers don't move that much for in terms of movement from one industry to another, or let me rephrase that, movement from one type of job to another. There is a fair amount of mobility from industry to industry, but in general, workers tend to move within the same broad job categories. Workers may move from production line workers to management and so on, or they may move from being lower level engineers to more senior engineers and so on, or they may move from being law clerks to being senior partners in law firms, but you don't see a tremendous amount of mobility from one broad category of occupation to another. That does serve as a barrier to mobility. However, as long as there's a fair number of people retiring every year and a fairly substantial number of people entering occupations every year, you still have this source of mobility which allows compensating wage differentials to exist, but the adjustment process may be relatively slow. So again, the extent to which the theory of compensating wage differentials is appropriate depends on the extent to which these conditions are satisfied. That for compensating wage differentials to be a reasonable measure of wage differences across individuals, workers have to make their decisions based on their overall level of happiness and satisfaction and not just income. Workers have to have perfect information about all the job characteristics, and furthermore, there has to be enough labor mobility available so that the wage differences do reflect equilibrium differentials caused by differences in non-wage job characteristics. To the extent to which any of these assumptions are violated, we won't necessarily see equilibrium compensating wage differentials existing. However, we'd still be able to use the model to at least explain some broad features or some broad reasons for differences across wages among different occupations and industries. Now, the basic model, the theoretical model we're going to use to explain these compensating wage differentials, is called a hedonic pricing model. Now, a hedonic pricing model is one where a commodity, it's used quite a bit in economics, and it's one where a commodity is sold at a given price, but the commodity possesses a set of characteristics that vary across the set of differentiated products that are offered in the market. An example of that, for example, is automobiles. That when you buy cars, you're actually buying a bundle of different features, many of which once you pick a given model car, you don't really have much control over. That once you buy a given model car, you're going to have a car that has a certain length, a certain width, a certain level of comfort. You're going to get a certain type of seats. You're going to get a certain size engine, perhaps. There may be some options which have some prices on them, but much of the variation in cars involves not changes in the options that you have associated with a different car, on a given car. Most of the variation occurs across differences in car models, so that you choose between a compact car or subcompact car or a luxury car or a minivan and so on. And that much of the variation involves those differences between one type of car or one model and another model. And what happens is you never directly observe, for example, a price on many of the individual characteristics. You don't observe, for example, how much more people are willing to pay to have a car that's 6 inches wider, or you don't observe how much people are willing to pay to have all a 20% increase in acceleration, or you don't observe how much necessarily people are willing to pay to have a more luxurious interior directly. Okay. However, there are, fortunately, some econometric techniques that allow you to work backwards. And what happens basically is you can come up with a hedonic pricing model that by analyzing, by keeping record of all the characteristics of these cars and the bundles of, or the price associated with each bundle of characteristics, you're able to go back and impute values of or implicit prices for the individual characteristics. So for example, using statistical techniques, that if you control everything else constantly, observe that one car is all 10% larger or let's say wider than another car, and the price of that is car on average is all $1,200 larger, when everything else is held constant, then that suggests that people are in fact willing to pay $1,200 extra for that increase in the width of the car. Okay, that's just one example of a hedonic pricing model. Hedonic pricing models are used for a wide variety of economic models, but again, they're generally used when you have a differentiated product sold by firms where you don't observe individual price differences on the characteristics, but you only observe prices associated with a given bundle of characteristics. Now, perhaps that's not the clearest way to state this. Let's go back a little bit and think of it in the following way. Suppose that instead of having people go into a supermarket and pay a different price for each commodity that gets rung up at the cash register, there the prices are very explicitly stated. Suppose instead that people were offered complete shopping carts filled with goods that sold at different prices, and you were faced with a very large number of different bundles or different shopping carts filled at different prices. If there were enough different shopping carts out there with enough different differences or enough variation in the components of these shopping carts, and you had a market where people were free to choose whichever shopping carts they wanted and so on, and there was, again, the suppliers out there determining how much they should charge for each particular shopping cart, you'd be able to observe differences in the prices of the overall bundles of goods, that you can observe how much is paid for, let's say, shopping basket A and shopping basket B. If the only difference between shopping basket A and shopping basket B is that one includes, let's say, a 3-pound container of detergent and the other one doesn't, the difference in price would give you a measure or an implicit measure of how much people are willing to pay for that detergent. Okay, that's basically how hedonic pricing models work, that as long as you have enough variation in all these characteristics, you're able to extract implicit prices for features that are not otherwise directly priced. But then how does this apply to the labor market? In the labor market, the same basic sort of model exists, that each job that workers are choosing from can be described as consisting of a set of characteristics. These characteristics involve, for example, the level of education or training required for the job, the risk of injury associated with working in the job, the level of job stress, whether the work is indoors or outdoors, the level of prestige associated with the job, and a whole host of other factors. That, in general, the job consists of all those things that individuals, or from our perspective, the characteristics include anything or all those things that individuals perceive as being important in choosing between or among alternative jobs. So each job has this bundle of characteristics and some sort of wage offer associated with it. And we're going to assume, of course, that these wage differentials are going to adjust to compensate for differences in these other characteristics. Now, let's begin talking about how these market wages can, or these market differentials or compensating wage differentials can exist. In particular, we're going to start with the case of the characteristic of the risk of on-the-job injury. Now, here we're going to look at a diagram that relates the level of rate wage with, or the wage rate with a job, and the associated risk of injury with a job. And we have an indifference curve here. The indifference curve provides a graph of all the alternative combinations of wages and risk that leave the individual as happy or as satisfied. And basically what we see here is that if the risk of injury on the job goes up, the wage rate would have to go up to compensate the individual for the additional risk. I think, again, the reason for this is pretty obvious. Individuals in general would prefer jobs that do not have a high risk of injury. If they realize that there's a greater risk of being injured on the job, wages would have to rise to compensate for that if the worker is to consider themselves as well off. Now, in general, we're going to assume that these indifference curves are convex. And the convexity here implies that if we move from point A to B, for example, the movement from A to B and from C to D, going back a step, involves the same increase in the risk of injury. But the movement from A to B occurs at a relatively lower level of risk to begin with. And what we observe is that for relatively low levels of risk, workers might be willing to, or if this description is correct, that when the level of risk increases from point A to B, it requires a relatively small increase in wage to compensate the worker for the additional risk. However, as the level of risk becomes higher, it requires progressively larger wage increases to compensate workers for the additional risk of injury. That, for example, worker, if they face an increase in the risk of injury from 1 to 2%, might perhaps not require a very large wage increase to compensate for that. But if the risk of injury goes up from perhaps 40 to 42%, it might require a larger increase in the wage to compensate. In general, we're going to assume that this sort of behavior holds, that as the level of risk becomes higher, that workers require progressively larger and larger compensations or wage differentials to compensate for the additional risk. That there is a fair amount of empirical evidence that suggests that this holds. Now, we're going to assume that points that lie above and to the left of the indifference curve are preferred to points on the indifference curve. The reason for that, I think, should be fairly obvious if we compare points F and G. That if we look at point G, we see that the wage rate is higher and the risk of injury is lower than at point F. And since workers prefer higher wages and prefer less risk, point G would be preferred on both criteria. So as you move in an upward and leftward direction, the level of utility increases. Note that this is different than other models of indifference curves you've seen probably in your other classes, and certainly it's different than our earlier model of labor supply or indifference curves in the labor supply setting. The reason, of course, is that the wage rate here is something which is desirable. It's an economic good, if you want to think of it that way, while the risk of injury is an economic bad. It's something that people are willing to pay something to avoid. Now, there's going to be an indifference curve that passes through each possible combination of wage rates and level of job risk. That utility increases, the wage rate rises, and the level of risk falls. So as we move from U0 to U1 to U2, the level of utility increases in each stage. Obviously, there's going to be an infinite number of such indifference curves here, and these are just three representative indifference curves. In general, we can see that individuals would always try to move as far to the left and upward as they can, given whatever constraints they're faced with. Now, individuals are going to differ, though, in terms of how they view risk, that some individuals are going to be more risk-averse than other individuals. It's suggested here that individuals with steeper indifference curves are more risk-averse than individuals with flatter indifference curves. And let's see why that's the case. That the indifference curves here, these are just two indifference curves for persons A and B that happen to cross at the point W0 and R0. And since they cross there, let's make a comparison. That's a common benchmark or common starting point. If we increase the level of risk from R0 to R1, person A would require a wage increase from W0 to W1A. Person B would require a wage increase from W0 to W1B. Since person A requires a larger increase in the wage to compensate for the additional risk, we say that person A is more risk-averse than person B. Now, we've just described the trade-offs facing individuals. Now we're going to have to look at the trade-off between wages and job risk that faces firms. And to do that, it's helpful to introduce the concept of an isoprofit curve. Now, in the model of job risk that we're examining, an isoprofit curve is going to be a graph that represents all the combinations of wage rates and level of risk that result in a given level of economic profits. So it's basically a set of all the combinations of wages and risks that results in a constant level of profits. Now, an isoprofit curve slopes upward because, suppose we start at the left, on the right here, that whenever we reduce risk and move to the left along this curve, the firm's costs are going to go up, lowering the firm's profits. In order to keep profits the same, the firm would have to lower wages by enough to offset the cost of reducing risk. Okay. So this curve here represents a zero profit isoprofit curve for firm X. And again, anywhere along here, the firm would have a zero level of profits. Now again, recall that we're talking about economic profits here rather than accounting profits. And economic profits is equal to total revenue minus all economic costs, which includes the opportunity cost of owner-supplied resources. So when firms are receiving zero economic profits, their accounting profits tend to be positive. Well, their accounting profits are virtually always positive in such a situation. Now, the concave shape that's drawn here for the isoprofit curves occurs because we assume typically that the cost of reducing risk, or the marginal cost of reducing risk, rises as the level of risk is reduced. So for example, suppose we start off at point A and move to point B. The movement from A to B involves a reduction in risk and a corresponding reduction in the wage. But we notice that the reduction in the wage is relatively small. When we move from point C to D, we have the same reduction in the level of risk, but we see a substantially larger reduction in the rate, in the wage rate. Now, the reason for this, I think, should be fairly obvious. It's consistent with other models we've seen of increase in marginal costs. The basic notion is that if firms are going to reduce risk, the first methods that they use would be the methods that are the least costly methods of reducing risk. For example, as we talked about in class, if you're dealing with cotton fibers in a textile mill, for example, the first techniques that would be used to reduce risk would be perhaps by providing relatively inexpensive masks that workers could wear that would reduce the amount of fibers that were breathed in. However, this would not filter out all the fibers. It would only filter out particles larger than a certain size. And it wouldn't work, obviously, when workers took them off or if there were gaps in the mask and so on. But that would reduce risk by quite a large amount without having a very large cost on the firm. However, as you keep reducing the level of risk, as you keep reducing particulates in the air, the cost of reducing risk is going to get progressively larger and larger. That to get rid of the perhaps the last 1% of the fibers in the air might cost 20 to 30 times as much as getting rid of the initial 1% of the fibers in the air. And this again follows the basic logic that firms will initially, as noted before, use whatever technique is least costly initially to reduce risk, but as you keep trying to reduce risk, you've already used the easiest methods and you've already reduced the most easily removed sources of risk. And to reduce risk further is going to require progressively more and more expensive methods. So we'd expect to see isoprofit curves being concave, as illustrated here. Now here, we've got three different sets of isoprofit curves corresponding to different levels of profits for firm X. If we think about what happens at a given level of risk, we see that the top curve provides higher wages than the zero isoprofit curve. And if the wage rates are higher for the same level of risk, that means the firm's costs must be higher. And if profits are zero along that middle curve, they obviously have to be negative when the level of costs are higher for the firm. So we know that the top curve would have to involve a negative level of profits for that isoprofit curve. For isoprofit curves that lie below the zero isoprofit curve, the wage rates are lower than those that would provide zero profits. And if the wage rates are lower than those that would result in zero profits, we know that the level of profits would have to be higher than that, or we'd see positive economic profits. Now, even though we have these three different isoprofit curves here, and there's an infinite number of possible isoprofit curves, fortunately, we're able to narrow down the range a little bit, at least if we think about this in a long-run context. because we know that, given what you've learned in your introductory economics courses, that economic profits, however, tend to zero in the long run equal, will be equal to zero in the long run equilibrium in any market in which there are no substantial barriers to entry. This includes perfectly competitive markets, monopolistically competitive markets, and contestable oligopoly markets. And therefore, we know that in the long run at least, the only one of these isoprofit curves we have to worry about is the isoprofit curves corresponding to a zero level of profits. Now, what's going to happen here is we're going to compare the marginal cost of reducing risk at any given level of risk across two different firms. That some firms will have a steeper isoprofit curve than others. In particular, the curve is going to be steeper for those firms that has a higher cost of risk reduction. If we compare, for example, firms X and Y here, they both share the point W0 and R0. However, suppose the level of risk is reduced to R1, that in firm X, the wage rate would have to be reduced from W0 to W1X. In firm Y, the wage rate would have to be reduced from W0 to W1Y. Now, remember, the wage change that's occurring here is a wage change needed to offset, or the change in the wage that's needed to offset the additional cost of the new technical procedures or the new equipment and so on, or the new production process that's required to reduce risk in this case. And if we see a larger wage reduction, that means that the cost of reducing risk must have been larger. So the cost of risk reduction here is substantially larger for firm Y than it is for firm X when we move from R0 to R1. In general, if we take a given level of risk and have two different isoprofit curves there, whichever one is steeper must face a higher marginal cost of risk reduction. Now, in terms of which job workers would choose, though, I think if we look at this diagram, we can see that if we start at point A, or at the level of risk associated with point A, that firms there would, a worker at point A would, when faced with a choice between working at firm Y or firm X, would always choose to work at firm X because firm X is able to offer a higher level of wage at that given level of risk than firm Y would. So when faced with a choice between the wage rate at firm A or the wage rate, at firm X or the wage rate that would be offered by firm Y, workers would always go to whichever firm paid the higher wage. So that for levels of risk corresponding for points A and B there, we'd see workers would locate at firm X. But as the level of risk becomes higher, it becomes optimal for workers to switch from firm X to firm Y because firm Y is able to offer a higher wage at higher levels of risk than firm X would. Because remember again, firms will always be operating on their zero isoprofit curve. And workers who are trying to get the best combination they can get would always prefer to have higher wages at any given level of risk as compared to lower wages, obviously. Now, in a more realistic situation, there's going to be a very large number of firms, perhaps thousands or tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands in a larger labor market, and all of them will have their own wage risk curves or their own wage risk isoprofit curves. And the same principle that we just discussed on the previous screen would still apply, that workers would always choose to locate at on, or choose to operate in, or choose to accept a job at whatever firm is offering them the highest wage for any given level of risk. So in making the choices, basically, at any given level of risk, firms would offer any point on their zero isoprofit curve, but workers would always choose whichever firm at that level of risk offers the highest possible wage payment. The more thickly shaded blue line here, or the blue curve here, is called a wage risk offer curve. And this describes all the combinations of wages and risk that do provide the highest potential wage offer from firms at any given level of risk. Each point on there corresponds to a particular job that offers a given level of wages and a given level of risk. Under the assumptions of this model, workers are assumed to maximize utility subject to this wage risk offer curve. And as we can see here, remember, utility increases as we move upward and to the left, For person A, at least, given these representative difference curves, the highest level of utility is achieved at the point of tangency between their indifference curve and the wage risk offer curve. This occurs here at the combination of WA and R sub A. That's the optimal combination of wages and risk for person A. Now we've introduced some indifference curves for person B, who, as we know, is less risk averse than person A. And given the flatter indifference curves for person B, the optimal point, again, occurs at a point of tangency, but in this case, for the less risk-averse person, person B, we see the optimal combination involves a higher level of wages and a higher level of risk. And this gives us a not surprising result, perhaps, that more risk-averse individuals will select jobs that have a relatively low level of risk and offer relatively lower wages. Individuals who are not as concerned about risk, who do not view risk as negatively, or who do not place as much weight on risk, or are not willing to give up as much money to reduce risk, end up accepting higher paying jobs in more risky occupations. Okay. So in a sense, we're ending up with a bit of an optimal sorting here from the perspective of workers, because risk-averse workers end up in the least risky jobs, and those individuals who are less risk-averse, those individuals who do not need as much compensation to accept risk, will automatically select the jobs that offer more compensation and pay higher wages. By the same token, though, we can know that in this optimal sorting of workers and firms, risk is being reduced by a larger amount in those firms in which the marginal cost of reducing risk is lower. Here we've reintroduced the isoprofit curves for firm X and firm Y. Firm X, we noted before, here we can see that firm X has a lower marginal cost of reducing risk than firm Y does. So what we see here is that the risk is being reduced by a larger amount for the firm where the cost of reducing risk is lower. Firm Y faces a higher marginal cost of reducing risk and reduces risk by less. So what ends up happening here is that in society as a whole, risk is being reduced by more for those firms where the cost of reducing risk is the lowest. There is a smaller amount of risk reduction in those occupations or in those firms where the cost of risk reduction is larger. That allows risk to be reduced at the lowest possible opportunity cost for society as a whole. So we end up with this optimal sorting. And this wage risk curve is the sort of relationship we'd expect to observe in the market, that when everything else is held constant, we'd expect to see higher wages associated with more risky occupations. We expect to see a similar relationship between the wage rate and the level of any other job attribute which is seen as being a negative, which is seen as lowering workers' utility. On the other hand, if we're dealing with a characteristic of a job that's seen as being desirable, we'd expect the offer curve associated with that to be a downward sloping curve. For example, if the variable we're looking at is perhaps the level of prestige associated with the job, you might expect to see a downward sloping curve, where the more prestigious the job is, holding everything else constant perhaps, the lower the wage rate associated with it. But again, for that sort of relationship to exist, that ceteris paribus assumption is very critical, because obviously we do observe that more prestigious jobs tend to be higher paid jobs. But the reason why they're higher paying in general is that we haven't held constant all the other characteristics. That if we take two jobs that are alike in every other way, a job which is seen as being more socially desirable or more having a higher status would in general be expected to offer a lower wage than the job which is seen as offering a lower social status in general. Okay, now in the next topic we'll talk about all this risk of injury argument in a bit more detail, and in particular we'll look at what happens when some of these assumptions are violated. In particular, what happens in a world in which we perhaps may not have perfect information. And in particular, we'll look at the effects of OSHA requirements and the economic arguments for and against OSHA requirements.